LRS and Will Acheson do not provide any legal advice. Listeners to this podcast and visitors to the LRS website should consult with their own lawyer for legal advice. LRS is not a law firm, and our employees are not acting as your attorney. The information contained in this podcast and on LRS.com is general legal information and should not be construed as legal advice to be applied to any specific factual situation.
Welcome to First Thursday. This is a podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Acheson, and over the course of the next 45 minutes or an hour or so, we will be going over recent developments in public safety labor relations, things that have occurred in the last month. And it has been a busy, busy month. We have a long-awaited decision from the United States Supreme Court on affirmative action. Even though that case is not an employment case, what the Supreme Court has done in the case will have, I think, a great deal of impact on the legality of affirmative action plans in public safety labor relations in the future. We have a very controversial case that has come to us out of the California Court of Appeals on the negotiability of disciplinary processes. And a wide variety of cases from around the country that are pushing at the envelope in different ways. Where to start with all of this? Let's start in California. And in order to set the stage appropriately for this case, and the case name, by the way, is Orange County Deputy Sheriffs versus County of Orange, a little bit about California's public safety collective bargaining law. In California, police and fire unions negotiate under what's known as the Meyer-Milius-Brown Act. And Meyer-Milius-Brown, or MMB as it's called, imposes an obligation on employers to meet and confer over a fairly standard listing of what is a mandatory subject of bargaining. The phrasing in Meyer-Milius-Brown is that there's an obligation to bargain over wages, hours, and working conditions. Owing to a lot of different reasons, it is rare that negotiability disputes make their way into the court system in California. For example, you can go one state north up into Oregon and you can find probably twice the number of court decisions over the negotiability of various topics as you would find in California, a far more populous state. Some of that has to do with whether or not binding arbitration is available. It is in Oregon. It's not in California, except as a local option. Some of it has to do with the fact that law enforcement officers weren't covered by the State Employment Relations Board in California for a long time. Different reasons why you don't see many negotiability disputes pop up. And when you do, I think because of their infrequency, you see some unusual results. And that, I think, is the case with the Orange County Deputy Sheriff's dispute. So what's going on in the Orange County case? Factually, for many, many years, the Sheriff's Department in Orange County had a past practice of allowing officers who were going to be questioned by Internal Affairs to review the IA file before the interview with the internal affairs investigator. You get a new sheriff who is selected, and the new sheriff decides that that past practice is inconsistent with the degree of integrity that she wants in her department. And effective January 1, 2011, she issues an order saying no more pre-interview access to IA files. And the labor organization representing the deputy sheriffs, which is the Association of Orange County Deputy Sheriffs, challenges the issuance of the order, taking the position, not unexpectedly, that this order concerns a mandatory subject of bargaining, that discipline is one of the most important of working conditions that is thought to be negotiable, and that access to an internal affairs file before giving an interview is a disciplinary procedure that is thus mandatory for bargaining. California Court of Appeals says no, it's not. The California Court of Appeals rationale is that when we take a look at working conditions, we're going to engage in a balancing test. And the balancing test is going to weigh on one hand the impact on employees and against, on the other hand, the impact on the public and on management rights of whatever this particular working condition is. And the court ends up saying that the change in practice in this case, and I'm quoting now, squarely falls into the category of a fundamental managerial decision falling within the department's freedom to manage its affairs unrelated to employment. It's a fascinating statement when you think about it. The notion is that access to an internal affairs file before giving an interview is, back to that quote, unrelated to employment. That is a result that, frankly, I don't think would be reached in pretty much any other state in the country. In fact, there are plenty of cases from other states around the country finding that a wide variety of disciplinary procedures, all of the elements of what you might think of as a public safety officer's Bill of Rights, are mandatory for bargaining. There are cases from Illinois and Wisconsin and Washington all saying those sorts of things, including some cases on access to internal affairs files prior to an interview. There are even cases in California that seem to be contradictory to what the Court of Appeals held in the Orange County case. There's a very, very long-standing case that involves the Long Beach Police Officers Association. This is a decision reached by the Court of Appeals in 1984. And the Long Beach case, involved a change in past practice as to whether or not officers would have the right to consult with an attorney prior to giving a statement about the use of deadly force. And in the Long Beach case, the court found that since that had an impact on discipline, or potential impact on discipline, that change was mandatorily negotiable. So it's hard to know exactly the extent to which this Orange County case is going to have legs. There are various divisions in the California Court of Appeals. The court is geographically divided. It may well be you even end up with a conflict between different elements of the Court of Appeals, a conflict that might have to be settled by the California Supreme Court. And it's tough to say where this issue, the negotiability of basically internal affairs procedures, where this issue will end up in California in terms of pure labor relations issues. That said, the California legislature has been more active than any other state legislature in the last 15 years in amending and expanding the statewide Public Safety Officers Bill of Rights. With Democrats in control of both houses in California, as well as a Democratic governor, it would not be shocking to see a proposal coming from either, for example, PORAC, the Peace Officers Research Association of California, or the International Association of Firefighters, a proposal that the legislature specifically amend either the collective bargaining statute or the Bill of Rights to make clear that internal affairs procedures are mandatory for collective bargaining. So the Orange County case is surprising, but I think it falls squarely in the we'll see department. While we're talking about internal affairs investigations and more particularly a Bill of Rights, let's move over to the adjoining state of Nevada and talk about an interesting case that comes out of the Nevada Supreme Court. This is a case that involves an officer with the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. Metro is the hybrid city-county agency that provides most law enforcement services down in the Clark County, Las Vegas area. This is Officer Lori Bish, and she's a member of the Las Vegas Police Protective Association. In 2008, Bish was off duty, and her dog bit the friend of Bish's daughter. Bish took the girl to an urgent care facility, but was unable to get in touch with the girl's mother. And Bish became worried that the urgent care facility would not provide medical treatment for the girl without a legal guardian present. So she represented to the urgent care center that she was in fact the mother of her daughter's friend. And she used her daughter's name and birthday to register the child with the urgent care facility. There wasn't any insurance fraud that was involved. Bish paid for the treatment with her own funds and didn't use employer-provided health insurance. But eventually, the girl's mother finds out about all this and files an internal affairs complaint with Metro, alleging that Bish had committed insurance fraud by misrepresenting the girl's identity. An IA investigation very quickly confirms that that charge was untrue, that in fact Bish had paid cash, but also decided that the misrepresentations made to the urgent care center may have involved, at a minimum, conduct unbecoming charges, and scheduled an internal affairs interview with Bish. Now, under Nevada's statewide Peace Officers Bill of Rights, an employee facing an internal affairs investigation has the right to representation by a union representative and let's kind of underline that word, and an attorney, if they so choose. Bish notified her labor organization that she had an attorney who would be representing her at the IA interview, but she also requested a union representative. The answer that was given by the Police Protective Association was, no, we've got a policy, and if you've got your own attorney, we're not going to send a union rep to an IA investigation. We don't need to. And eventually, Metro, the interview goes as planned. Metro sustains a conduct unbecoming charge and issues a written reprimand. Bish is not happy. Bish, by the way, is somewhat of a political character. She has run for sheriff in the past in Clark County. Bish files an unfair labor practice complaint with Nevada's Employee Management Relations Board, saying that the PPA breached its duty of fair representation to her by not providing her with an attorney. And that case ends up making it to the Nevada Supreme Court, which reaches the right result for an odd reason. The reason that the court reached the result it did was its conclusion that the Bill of Rights did not impose any duties on a labor organization to provide representation, but it instead only provided the employee with the option of having representatives of his or her choosing present at the at an interrogation. And thus, the court concludes, the statute, the Bill of Rights, doesn't impose any additional obligations on the PPA and does not govern the PPA's responsibility toward its members. Okay, I think that's pretty clear. There's nothing in a Bill of Rights, statewide Bill of Rights I've ever seen, that imposes a duty on a labor organization to represent an employee. But didn't the PPA potentially have a duty of fair representation not arising out of the Bill of Rights, but arising out of the fact that discipline is a mandatory for subject for bargaining under Nevada law? And shouldn't the Supreme Court have analyzed whether or not the PPA's decision-making breached that duty of fair representation? I think the answer to both of those is probably yes, that in fact discipline is a mandatory subject of bargaining, so the PPA at least had a duty to consider representing Bish. Would the result have been different? I don't think so, because it's a perfectly permissible decision within the range of the PPA's discretion not to provide a representative to an employee who has an attorney ready to represent him or her in the internal affairs and investigation. That would be considered within the wide range of discretion that labor unions have to either take on or not take on a case. But there's even a more fundamental issue here about the duty of fair representation that, when I read this opinion, bugged me a little bit. The duty of fair representation only applies where the union is the exclusive representative of the employee. And where's that? Usually that's in the grievance procedure under a collective bargaining agreement, or else it could be in the bargaining process itself. If somebody else has the ability to represent the employee in a particular forum, courts very resolutely say there is no duty of fair representation in that particular forum. So you see, for example, holdings from courts that there is no duty of fair representation that would require providing an attorney in a workers' compensation case or an unemployment compensation case or in criminal proceedings against the employee, even if they arise out of the job. There's no duty of fair representation because somebody else can represent the employee in that forum. That somebody else being, of course, an attorney. Well, isn't that true in an internal affairs investigation in Nevada? Under the Bill of Rights, the employee can be represented by an attorney and the labor organization. I think the easier way for the Nevada Supreme Court to have gone on this case is to say, hey, look, no duty of fair representation at all, because the union is not the exclusive representative of the employee in this particular forum. So it's a case, I think, of the Nevada Supreme Court reaching the right result in the case, but reaching the right result in a very unusual way. And now to the Supreme Court's affirmative action decision released on June 24th of this year. We have been anticipating an awful lot from this case. There is still a considerable disagreement as to what the law allows with respect to affirmative action programs and the degree to which affirmative action programs can take into account race and gender. Unfortunately, after reading the court's opinion in Fisher versus University of Texas, I'm convinced we're no closer to getting answers as to the circumstances under which an affirmative action plan can take into account race. Here's what the case was about. The University of Texas had a variety of different admissions programs, and in one of those programs, it explicitly listed race as a factor. An applicant's race did not give a certain number of points, but there was no question but that race was, in the words of the Supreme Court, a meaningful factor in the admissions system. A white applicant who was not admitted sued, and that's the case that eventually made it up to the United States Supreme Court. And even though this is a case involving admission into a college, the standards with respect to the operation of the affirmative action program would have full reference in an employment setting. I don't think you're going to see any different result as to whether an affirmative action program is legal or not legal in employment versus educational admissions. I think it's going to be essentially the same. So what did the court say in Fisher versus University of Texas? It's probably not an unfair summary to say that the court basically punted on the issue of affirmative action plans. Reading kind of between the lines of the court's opinion, if all of the stars are lined up exactly correctly, an employer might be able to take into account race in making an employment decision. But all of those stars have to be lined up exactly correctly. Here's where the court started. The court said, first of all, it is legitimate for a university to take into account diversity among its student body. That is a legitimate judgment, or can be a legitimate judgment, that diversity is essential to a university's educational mission. Same could be said, by the way, of many public employment settings. There are certainly a number of police officer cases holding that racial diversity is an important element of a law enforcement agency's ability to deliver services in certain areas of the community. So the start of the opinion in Texas does find some kind of common ground with the employment setting. However, the court then goes on to say that just simply because a university says that diversity is an important factor, that doesn't end the case. Instead, the university, in this case, has to prove that the means that it chose to attain diversity are narrowly tailored to the goal of increasing diversity. And the court made very clear that the university gets no deference. The court's not going to cut it any slack because it's making an educational judgment. Instead, it's the obligation of the courts to determine that the admissions process must ensure that each applicant is evaluated as an individual and not in a way that makes an applicant's race or ethnicity the defining feature of the application. Now here comes, I think, probably the most important part of the court's decision for our purposes in employment. The court says that any court reviewing an affirmative action plan must verify that it's necessary for a university, think employer, to use race to achieve the educational benefits of diversity. And that means that a court has to ask whether diversity could be achieved without using racial classifications. The way the court put it was, the reviewing court must ultimately be satisfied that no workable race-neutral alternatives would produce the benefits of diversity. And if a non-racial approach could promote those benefits and at tolerable administrative expense, then the university can't consider race. And of course, the court emphasizes one more time, it's not that the dispositive aspect of a decision can be race. If race is going to be permitted at all, assuming that the university or an employer can jump all of these hurdles, then it simply has to be one factor in the process. It can't be the factor in the process and cannot be assigned a certain number of points that are blended together with other points to give the final rating to an applicant. What did the court do with the facts before it in the Fisher versus University of Texas case? It decided that there hadn't been enough of a hearing in the lower courts and sent the case back down for determination as to whether or not there were any non-racial alternatives to achieving diversity in the University of Texas. In other words, the court basically did not change the existing standards with respect to affirmative action, emphasized that affirmative action is something that can be very rarely used if it is going to explicitly take into account race, and also made it very clear that affirmative action that explicitly takes into account race is a last alternative. What we didn't hear from the court may be as important as what we did hear. There were a lot of people who were counting noses on the Supreme Court and thought they had gotten to 5 of the 9 justices favoring declaring all affirmative action plans that take race into consideration illegal as violating the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. And in fact, that didn't happen in this case. There's a fairly lengthy dissenting opinion from Justice Clarence Thomas, who argued that in fact, any consideration of race violates the equal protection guarantees of the 14th Amendment, but that's a dissenting opinion and it didn't carry the day. So affirmative action is still with us, but on an extremely limited basis. Next up, an interesting case out of Ohio. It's a case that involves the termination of a firefighter paramedic and the standards for the review of arbitrators' decisions. So here's what goes on in this case. This is a case involving Richard Urich. Urich is a firefighter with the city of North Royalton, Ohio. And in 2010, Urich and two other firefighters were dispatched to assist a resident who had suffered an apparent seizure. On arriving at the scene, the paramedics quickly figure out that the patient had a history of heroin abuse. They force their way into the bathroom and find the patient unconscious on the bathroom floor. Urich goes right to work. He establishes an IV line, injects a drug, Narcan, into the patient's system. It's a drug that counteracts a potential heroin overdose. The patient regains consciousness and within minutes is able to walk out to the rescue squad car to be transported to a hospital. What becomes the basis for this case is what goes on next. Before he leaves the bathroom with the patient, Urich flushed the toilet containing paper and debris, potential evidence of the use of heroin. Urich also inserted a syringe that had apparently been used by the patient and a small package wrapped with a rubber band inside the empty Narcan box. His explanation is that he's flushing this stuff down the toilet to protect the safety of the patient's child, and he's removing the syringe for the same reason. Eventually, an internal affairs investigation starts. It turns into a criminal investigation, and Urich is arrested and formally charged with three felonies: tampering with evidence, obstructing justice, and drug possession. He pleads guilty to a single count of attempted obstruction of justice, and then the city fires him. His labor organization, Local 2156 of the IAFF, challenges the termination and arbitration, and an arbitrator decides that termination is too harsh a penalty under these circumstances. The arbitrator is very clearly concerned about Urich's conduct from beginning till end, particularly concerned about the fact that when police were finally involved in the incident, Urich's initial response was to lie to the police about what had happened. But the arbitrator looks at Urich's long and positive work record and ends up reinstating him without back pay. The city then challenges the arbitrator's decision on public policy grounds and points to an Ohio decision in which the Court of Appeals in Ohio had said an arbitrator's opinion reinstating a police officer who was untruthful violates public policy. Now, you've heard me talk about this notion of public policy and law enforcement dishonesty cases in the past, and the law is in almost spectacular disarray as to whether or not arbitrators can reinstate police officers who are untruthful. Most courts say that that is within an arbitrator's discretion. There are a few outlier states. In particular, there's a recent decision out of Connecticut and an older case, the one I'm talking about here in Ohio, saying that the nature of a police officer's job just simply is incompatible with being untruthful, and thus an arbitrator's decision reinstating an untruthful police officer per se violates public policy. So the city, not surprisingly, challenges the arbitrator's decision in Urich's case, saying, look, the requirements for honesty among firefighters and paramedics are every bit as significant as the requirements for law enforcement officers. Urich admits he lied to the police and engaged in this generally dishonest behavior concerning the syringe and the drug paraphernalia. This arbitrator's decision has to violate public policy under prior Ohio precedent. Not so fast, says the Ohio Court of Appeals. And here's the court's rationale. The court says that in recognizing that a clear public policy existed in prohibiting the reinstatement of police officers who falsified reports. We have emphasized that a state statute recognizes that the police force of a municipal corporation is obliged to preserve the peace, protect persons and property, and obey and enforce all criminal laws of the states and the United States. Now get ready. These same considerations, however, do not apply to a firefighter, paramedic, nor are they delineated under the statute with respect to firefighters. Thus, while we don't condone dishonesty and recognize it's disfavored in the workplace, we can't say there's a public policy that mandates that all acts of dishonesty by firefighters warrant immediate termination. The result, the arbitrator's opinion is upheld. And so when I say that the law with respect to the reinstatement of police officers who have been dishonest is in almost spectacular disarray, add to that that the law with respect to the difference between police officers and firefighters dealing with dishonesty now seems to be in disarray as well. While we're on the subject of arbitrators' opinions, let's talk about a kind of a less controversial proposition, and that is the general standard that arbitrators' opinions face when challenged in court. And we've got a Rhode Island case, one out of the Rhode Island Supreme Court, involving the State Department of Corrections and the Rhode Island Brotherhood of Corrections Officers. That illustrates, I think very well illustrates, the general principle. And the general principle is arbitrators, as the Supreme Court of the United States has said, arbitrators can be wrong on the law and wrong on the facts, and their arbitration opinions will be upheld because you, the parties, management and labor, have bargained for final and binding arbitration decisions. The Rhode Island case involved the policies concerning firearms training in the Department of Corrections. There is a state statute that provides that corrections officers have to not only qualify with their weapons, but they have to repeat weapons qualifications every 2 years. And for years and years, the Department of Corrections had conducted live fire firearms qualifications and training every year, which easily complied with the requirement that qualifications happen every 2 years. The department then announces a change in its practices, and then under the new practice, it will only conduct live fire qualifications every other year. And on the off years, the DOC purchased a computer system known as PRISM, a firearm simulation program, and they would use PRISM training rather than live fire changing or live fire qualifications. And the union challenges this. This is the Rhode Island Brotherhood of Correctional Officers, challenges the policy in arbitration. An arbitrator upholds the grievance, and the arbitrator ends up concluding that the state's argument, which is that the state statute only mandates that it conduct training every 2 years, that state statute doesn't prohibit annual qualification, and you have a past practice of annual qualification. A past practice that concerns a safety issue, weapons qualification generally thought to be a safety issue, which is mandatory for bargaining, and thus the employer couldn't make a change in that past practice. The state challenges that arbitrator's opinion all the way up to the Rhode Island Supreme Court. And the Rhode Island, the most important thing I think about the Rhode Island Supreme Court's opinion is the standard that the court uses to judge the arbitrator's opinion. And the standard is this: is the arbitrator's decision, and I'm quoting, passably plausible? And in this case, the court says it is. The court's reading was that the statute provides that law enforcement officers have to repeat weapons qualifications at least every 2 years, and the arbitrator read the statute to mean that corrections officers could qualify every 2 years, but that the statute set the maximum time period, not the minimum time period, and that thus the past practice was enforceable. That conclusion, the Rhode Island Supreme Court says, is passively plausible. While we're talking about cases that are good examples of general trends, let's go on down to a sexual harassment case out of Miami Beach. Sexual harassment cases are so difficult to prove now. There have been a series of, depends on how you count, but probably 5 Supreme Court decisions in the last dozen years that have greatly constricted the scope of what is legally actionable sexual harassment. It's very much safe to say today that what might have been considered a no-brainer incident of sexual harassment 10 years ago today would probably be dismissed in court because the standards are so difficult. And I think this case out of Miami Beach is an excellent illustration of it. It's a case involving Marlena Smart, who's a firefighter with the city of Miami Beach, Florida. She sued the city for sexual harassment, and the case actually went to a jury, and she won a $700,000 verdict after a jury trial. The city filed a motion to overturn the jury's verdict, claiming, and here's the standard the city had to meet, that there was no conceivable basis for a legal conclusion that sexual harassment occurred. And here's the court's recitation of the incidents, of what happened to Smart. The court says there were 12 incidents of harassment over a 5-year period of time. In the court's words, only a handful of the incidents that Smart encountered could even arguably be considered events that are sexual or gender-based. Now, what are the incidents that the court puts in that category that the court thinks could arguably be called gender-based? An incident where Smart's bathing suit went missing and then was placed in a locker possibly containing semen. Where she was called a bimbo and a cunt, where she had a male co-worker walk in while she was taking a shower, where she was called promiscuous. All of those things, the court says, those arguably are gender-based. But then the court goes on to say this. The incidents Smart identifies were single occurring instances that, while inappropriate, vulgar, and offensive, were not severe. Given that there were 3 to 4 incidents over a 5-year period, it certainly was not pervasive. 2 of the more blatant occurrences, being called sexually degrading names and having her belongings thrown about the station, came following either a heated argument with Smart or an impression that Smart disregarded protocol of the station. The evidence demonstrates that the behavior of Smart's co-workers, while aberrant and unprofessional, was related to personality conflicts with Smart or her co-workers' perception of her being difficult to get along with. Thus, the court says, no sexual harassment. Now, this is, might seem to be an extreme case where that illustrates how far the rules have changed with respect to sexual harassment. And certainly you can argue whether or not the court reached the right decision here, because after a jury verdict, the court has to be able to say there's no possibility, no reasonable possibility, that these incidents could have been motivated by gender discrimination. And can you really say that when you have an employee who's being called a bimbo and a cunt and promiscuous and has her bathing suit placed in a locker after perhaps semen is placed on it? Can you really say that that's not gender-based? So you might be able to say the court is wrong here, but the court's decision indicates a very, very clear trend. and that is federal courts are not interested in claims of gender discrimination or race discrimination in employment. And the legal standards that have been erected to judge these cases make it almost impossible for employees to win these sorts of cases. Every month, I try to read all of the court decisions involving public safety employees, and every month, there are gender and race discrimination lawsuits that are filed all around the country. Different judges, different philosophies towards the system and the like, and yet the results are just, it's like a drumbeat. It's so rare to see a successful gender or race discrimination lawsuit. Easily, 9 out of 10 of these cases never even make it to a jury. And then some of them, many of them, that do make it to a jury either result in a loss by the employee at the before the jury, or in Smart's case, result in a win that is later taken away by a judge. Very, very difficult claim to make today, gender discrimination or race discrimination. It's been a First Amendment month. We have a lot of cases that involve First Amendment issues and public safety employees. And let's start with the musical case. Here from Irvington, New Jersey, is Gat the Great.
You recording? Hey Malik, turn my mic up, get ready to pump the music. Rappers, better back up, cause Gat's about to lose it. Sipping vodka, chief rocker, off the Richter. I won't stop a damn thing until you get the picture. Punk, chump, committee, you're carrying faggot. Beat with Gat, it's like offering a Muslim book, I won't have it. Static cling, and just like an addict, I bring drama. So pause like a...
Well, Gat the Great actually is the president of the police union in Irvington, New Jersey. His real name is Maurice Gaddison, and that song that you heard, it's associated with a video, by the way, that song that you heard is now the basis of disciplinary proceedings against Gaddison. Why? Because in part, in the lyrics in the song, that song's name, by the way, is Temper Like an Alcoholic, Gaddison uses the word faggot several times and makes promises of violence against his rival. A local city politician has made it very clear that he thinks that Gat the Great should be fired for this. And very clearly, Gaddison, in response, thinks that the First Amendment protects the video and protects the lyrics. And the battle lines appear to be drawn in Irvington, New Jersey. How's this one likely to come out? And assuming that cooler heads do not prevail in Irvington, we could be looking at a multi-year battle here. How is this likely to come out? And the law in this area, and I think of it as art speech, sometimes you have to very broadly use the word art when you're describing art speech. The law in this area is actually pretty conflicted, and it makes it kind of difficult to figure out how the First Amendment is going to play into Gaddison's video. There's an old case, and it comes out of Baltimore, Maryland, and this involved a white police officer who had a part-time job as an actor. And in his actor's role, what he would do would be to put burned cork on his face so that he looked like a black man, and would sing Al Jolson songs. Remember, Al Jolson is a white singer from the turn of the 20th century who used to do the same thing, who used to put burned cork on his face and sing minstrel songs from the South. The Baltimore police officer was fired and eventually got his job back with full back pay. And the court said, this is artistic speech. Now contrast that with a much more recent decision from about 3 years ago, where a number of firefighters in New York City, in one of the many parades that New York has every year, were on a float where they were, I would say, acting out African-American stereotypes. They were eating fried chicken and watermelon and and they too had colored their faces. They were fired by Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and courts ended up upholding their discharge, saying that because they were readily identifiable as firefighters, that they had an obligation to not engage in speech that that exhibited pervasive racial stereotypes. And I actually think that that latter sensibility, rather than the Baltimore case, is probably where the law is today. We've seen a much greater restriction on the off-duty speech of police officers and firefighters. There's nothing in Gaddison's case that suggests an on-duty involvement, so that certainly mitigates the potential that he faces. But I would be concerned if I was representing Gaddison that a court might end up concluding that the racially insensitive and potentially homophobic remarks that are in the video might properly be the basis for discipline and not covered by the First Amendment. Let's see. Like I said, long way to go on this case, and it is clear that the First Amendment lines are drawn. While we're talking about the First Amendment, let's move on over to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which is one of the most important courts of appeals in the country. It covers the area of the nation, including New York and nearby states. This is a case involving a corrections officer, a fellow named Kent Singer. He's a corporal in the Ulster County Jail in New York. And while he was at work, he created a parody advertisement on his work computer. Now, you probably are familiar with the Absolut Vodka ads, where a vodka bottle is put into different settings. It can be a ski run or a chimney or whatever it might be. And beneath the bottle, there'll be a two-word phrase that begins with the word Absolut. Well, what Singer's version of this advertisement did was to have a bottle ad, or the bottle, the Absolut vodka bottle, with the pictures of four corrections supervisors, four of his bosses, including the warden, and the caption read, Absolut Corruption. Singer's got this idea from the internet. Apparently that you can find other examples of Absolut Corruption advertisements out there. And Singer distributed this parody, showed this parody to five fellow employees. He thought of it as a political statement and also something that was funny. And Singer thought better of it, though, very quickly, and threw his copy of it, which was really the only copy, threw his copy into a trash can in a common area used by other employees. However, an employee retrieved it from the trash, and the advertisement or the parody made its way to the people depicted on the bottle. Singer later is the subject of a number of administrative actions. He thinks they're retaliation was promoted by this advertisement, and he filed a lawsuit saying that his free speech rights were violated by the retaliation. That, in other words, that the advertisement itself, the parody, was protected by freedom of speech. The Second Circuit, which hasn't had a lot of these free speech cases, the Second Circuit starts with the basic question in all of these cases, which is this writing, in this case, this parody, is this about a matter of public interest? And the court determines that it wasn't. And here's the court's analysis of it. The court says the corrupt practices referred to by Singer's parody are at best of marginal public interest. Most of them, and Singer identified these in a deposition, by the way, most of them, payroll discrepancies, promotions, and discipline, are employment-related matters. It's possible that corruption in these respects, if sufficiently egregious or widespread, might be a matter of public concern. But here's the court's conclusion. We don't think the public has a substantial interest in minor payroll discrepancies among corrections department staff, or an isolated promotion to middle management, or an arrest 16 years before, or rumors of womanizing. Each of these, the court says, falls far from the kind of legitimate and understandable concerns the public would have about the running of a correctional facility. So in other words, because Singer wasn't able to prove that his statements were a matter of public interest, his retaliation lawsuit ends up getting dismissed. Fairly standard analysis by the Second Circuit. Now let's move on to another element of the First Amendment and a whistleblowing case out of Michigan. And I find this case to be very important because I think it's the start of, or the ground floor of, what's going to be a trend. And that is that employees will find some way, any way, of raising First Amendment issues other than by invoking the First Amendment itself. Why the reluctance to invoke the First Amendment? It's because of the very, very strict standards that have been created by the U.S. Supreme Court in First Amendment cases. I've talked in the past about the Supreme Court's decision in Garcetti versus Sabalos, in which the court says that speech that is made as part of the job is not constitutionally protected, meaning an employer can discipline an employee for perfectly truthful speech, can even fire the employee for the speech, if the speech is part of the employee's job. Now, that's one line of cases, the Garcetti line of cases, that render unprotected a great deal of free speech. There's another line of cases, it's even an older line of cases, that analyzes the employee's motivation for engaging in the speech. And if the motivation is that whatever it is the topic of the speech is a purely personal dispute, or a purely personal employment matter, then it's not going to be protected. But if instead the motivation is to bring the public's attention to a broader issue of public importance, then the speech is more likely to be protected. And it's because of these two twin lines of thought in First Amendment jurisprudence that we find employees, and again, this trend is just starting, raising First Amendment, what you would think of as First Amendment claims, pretty much anywhere else except in a federal court lawsuit. You see these claims raised in disciplinary cases, grievances challenging the imposition of discipline. You see them in civil service cases. And most notably, you see it in lawsuits filed under whistleblower statutes. Most states have whistleblower statutes, not all. There's no federal whistleblowing law that applies to state and local governmental employees. So protection of these statutes exists depending upon what state you're in. And as I say, the majority of states do have whistleblowing statutes. And usually the way these statutes are written is that an employee cannot be disciplined for making a complaint that another employee has engaged in criminal misconduct or somehow violated the law. We're protecting whistleblowers. Well, here's the case that comes out of Michigan that I think is a good illustration of this trend of bringing what might have been a First Amendment case in another setting. This case involves Bruce Whitman, who is the police chief of the city of Burton, Michigan, from 2002 to 2007. City's mayor decides not to reappoint Whitman, and Whitman sues the city under Michigan's whistleblower law. There it's called the Whistleblower Protection Act. And Whitman's claim is that the mayor's decision not to reappoint him was prompted by Whitman's repeated complaints to the mayor and the city attorney that the refusal to pay Whitman's previously accumulated unused sick leave and personal leave time would violate an ordinance. Now, is that the stuff of which First Amendment protection is made? Well, not today. It might have been some time ago, whether or not the employer was complying with its own ordinances with respect to payroll processes. But today, I think a court would look at that and say, because Whitman's complaints concerned his own paycheck, his own unused sick and personal leave time, that would be characterized by the courts as a purely personal dispute not worthy of First Amendment protection. But does that defense apply in a whistleblower type case? Well, what goes on here is Whitman gets to a jury on the issue, and jury sides with him and awards him a little bit more than $250,000 of damage, and the city appeals. And the city, before the Michigan Supreme Court, argues that the same standard should apply in whistleblower cases as applies in First Amendment cases. In other words, that we need to look at the motivation of the employee. And if this is, in fact, a purely personal dispute, there should be no whistleblower protection. And the Michigan Supreme Court says, not so. The court says that it has explained many times in the past that, and I'm quoting now, the whistleblower law meets its objective of protecting the public by protecting the whistleblowing employee and removing barriers to employee efforts to report violations of the law. As long as the employee demonstrates a causal connection between the protected activity and the adverse employment action, and here's the important part, the subjective motivation for engaging in the protective activity in the first instance is not relevant as to whether or not the employee can recover under the whistleblower law. So in other words, the court says, we're not going to apply that First Amendment personal motivation defense in a whistleblower case. All we need is, first of all, that the employee engaged in protected conduct. Here, Whitman did. He reported what he believed to be a violation of a city ordinance. And secondly, we need an adverse employment action that has a nexus to that protected activity. And here, the failure to reappoint Whitman was the adverse employment action. So the Supreme Court basically upholds, Supreme Court of Michigan, upholds Whitman's claims. It sends the case back down to the trial court to resolve a variety of remaining legal issues. But the heart of the case is that standard First Amendment defenses don't apply in a whistleblowing case. And I think that's going to be the result you're going to see under pretty much any whistleblowing statute. And I think that's one of the reasons you're going to see employees bringing these cases under whistleblowing statutes rather than under the First Amendment. Let's wind up our free speech case summary. And boy, we had a lot to pick from this month with a monster case, a potentially monster case, and at least in terms of the potential damages in the case, out of Connecticut. In Connecticut, there's a bargaining coalition. It's called the State Employees Bargaining Agent Coalition. And it includes 13 public employee unions. They represent about 40,000 Connecticut state employees. And the way it works is that the coalition bargains a master agreement, a master collective bargaining agreement that covers all 13 unions and 40,000 employees. And then the 13 constituent unions will then go out and bargain their own supplemental agreements that may change working conditions or set different hours of work or whatever for the members of their particular union. This case dates back to 2002 when the state of Connecticut met with the coalition and asked for $450 million in long-term concessions. At the time, the state employed about 50,000 individuals, and approximately 75% of those employees were members of the coalition, and about 25% were not. The state told the coalition, unless you agree to the $450 million in concessions, we will fire 3,000 unionized state employees. The union came, or the union, the coalition
came back with counter proposals and offered alternate concessions. But the governor, John Rowland, figured he'd drawn a line in the sand. He rejected the coalition's counter proposals and fired 2,800 unionized employees. And the firings were effectuated in 2003. No non-union workers were fired. The coalition then sues Rowland and the state, contending that the firings violated the First Amendment. What part of the First Amendment? Well, we tend to forget sometimes that the First Amendment's protection of freedom of speech includes within it what's called a freedom of association. And this is the right that we have to associate, in particular, with groups. The first case that established freedom of association involved the right of citizens to become members of the NAACP. Over the years, courts have found that freedom of association protects union membership, that in fact there is a First Amendment component to union membership. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which ends up with the coalition's lawsuit, described it this way: conditioning public employment on union membership, no less than on political association, inhibits protected association and interferes with government employees' freedom to associate. In other words, there's a First Amendment notion to membership in the coalition. The court then turned to the heart of the issue. And here's the way the court put it, and I could summarize this, but I really couldn't put it better than the court did. The state argues that it needed to reduce the cost of its workforce, and that since the coalition refused the proposed concessions, the state was then forced to lay off its union workers to reduce its cost. But the facts make clear that the firings were not tailored to reduce the cost of the state's workforce. To the contrary, the firings had minimal effect on the state's expenses, and the savings realized from the firings, says the court, didn't correlate to the concessions requested from the unions. And in fact, the firings weren't even included in the governor's budget message. And now to the most important part, the court says the state hasn't shown why the state's fiscal health required firing only union members rather than implementing membership-neutral layoffs. All state employees, whether they belong to unions or not, get the same health care and benefits. There's no support for an argument, says the court, that union members cost more, provided fewer services, or were somehow distinguishable from their non-union cohorts. So the court ends up upholding the First Amendment claims of the coalition. Why do I say this is going to be a massive case? Think about this for a moment. 2,800 employees fired, and they were fired in 2003. What will the back pay be? What will the likely remedy be? Could be huge, depending upon when the employees were rehired into state government, all sorts of different questions about mitigation of damages. But this could be a multi-million dollar case, maybe multi-tens of millions of dollars in this case. Let's turn now to contracts in the news, and the one I'm going to talk about the most is just one of the most striking contracts that I have seen in a long time, and it comes to us from New York, New Rochelle, New York. Why is it striking? It's a 10-year contract. This is a kind of a mid-sized police union, 117 members. It's a contract that's got some retroactivity in it. It goes back to 2010, and it will run through the end of 2019. I actually don't remember ever seeing a 10-year collective bargaining agreement in the public sector. For a while there was a Chicago firefighter contract that was an 8-year contract, but even that's extraordinarily rare. And it's not till you get to 5- and 6-year contracts that you see any number of contracts that end up with that lengthy a term. But a 10-year collective bargaining agreement, it's pretty amazing. So what are the terms of this agreement? By the way, it was voluntarily reached. It wasn't done through arbitration. This calls for raises of 1.5% for each of the first 2 years of the contract. So these are the two retroactive years. 2% for each of the next 3 years, and raises of 3% a year from 2015 to 2019. So pretty steady raises, in fact, very steady raises over the entire 10-year term of the contract. There'll be a step that is going to be added to the salary system. So it will take officers a little bit longer to reach the top level of pay. And also, you're going to see a lowering of the starting salary. Starting salary as of January 2013, starting salary will be $50,310 a year. And that will drop to $45,000 a year, a little bit more than $45,000 a year by July of 2013. The news article that best describes this deal quotes Randolph McLaughlin, who is characterized as a lawyer and a professor who teaches labor law at Pace University, quotes him as looking at this with a jaundiced eye from the union standpoint. McLaughlin says it's clear why management would want a 10-year deal. It gives stability and makes planning much easier. But he's really skeptical for the union. He says, I can't imagine why a union would agree to a deal like this because I don't have any idea what the cost of living is going to be in 6 years. With all respect to Mr. McLaughlin, who I don't know, I completely understand why a union would agree to a deal that goes out through 2009, the end of 2009. First of all, it's only 6 years in advance. Secondly, we have seen since the early 1980s the Federal Reserve make control over inflation such a high priority that we have seen the average rate of inflation over that time period since the early 1980s has actually been less than the average wage increase called for by this deal. And also, unions want stability now, particularly with the fact that the economic recovery among many public sector agencies is not as quick or as strong as many of us had hoped. Unions, you know, would love the stability of a long-term deal protecting health insurance, potentially protecting pensions, certainly protecting other benefits. They would love that sort of deal. So I take a look at it a little bit differently than Professor McLaughlin. I think this is a deal that, while I can certainly see the interests of the city in budgeting and planning, I can certainly see those interests. I can see why a union would be even more interested in a long-term arrangement like this. The other contracts we're seeing from around the country are following the general trend that we've been seeing all year. And these are contracts that are in the 1.5% to 2% range. Probably the one that is most notable of all of them comes to us from Buffalo, New York, involving the fire department. This is the first contract in Buffalo Fire Department in 10 years. And this is a contract that will be from 2013 to 2016. And it will call for a raise of 2% annually. Because of some back pay and retroactive adjustments and everything, the contract will result in a 13.5% wage increase immediately for the most senior firefighters. There's a lot in this deal for the city as well, beyond the notion of finally putting to bed a contract after 10 years. There's going to be a residency requirement for firefighters hired after January 1, 2012, and there'll be an increase in pay steps from 5 to 13, so the wages will be stretched out over a much longer period of time. And that's it for our podcast, for our first Thursday podcast for July of 2013. We hope to see you in August. Thanks.